I think the government's going to find it quite difficult in the High Court. And the Prime Minister has suggested that he has confidence the High Court will decide that the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, will be cleared. I don't have that confidence. I actually think it's more likely than not that he'll be struck out. And I think in this area, you really need to be very cautious about predicting what the court will do in any event.
So that was George Williams on the fiasco, the imbroglio, the crisis, whatever your preferred terminology. He is the Dean and Anthony Mason Professor at UNSW Law. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia and also the host, obviously, of this pod. With the High Court of Australia about to hear challenges to the same-sex marriage postal survey and a bunch of other cases about whether politicians are eligible to be in the parliament, I thought it'd be helpful this week to bring in a full-time whisperer of the Australian Constitution. And we're going to sift through all of the issues currently before the High Court and take a stab about where the learned ones down the road may end up at the conclusion of all of these processes. So sit back, relax, and here comes an interesting conversation. So, George Williams, thank you for joining Australian Politics Live.
My pleasure.
Now, I think we ought to begin at the beginning and not assume that every listener is an expert in constitutional law, or even that the podcast host is an expert in constitutional law, hence you being in the pod cupboard this week. So let's begin at the beginning. What are these cases about in the broad? What are they about?
Well, what's been described as a debacle, a fiasco, a crisis when it comes to dual citizenship in Australia all stems back to one section of our constitution, which is a 1901 document, the founding document of the Australian nation. And back in 1901, it was thought sensible to put in there a clause that says you cannot be a subject or citizen of a foreign power and sit in our federal parliament. Back at that time, it made sense because there was no Australian citizenship. In fact, we were British subjects in common with Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, so all of those countries could stand for our parliament. But what happened since is we've got Australian citizenship being developed in 1949, our own independence, and now this clause in knocking out dual nationals has become very, very prominent because its scope is much larger because of the capacity for people from other countries to be falling within the exclusion.
Because so many of us have got foreign connections, because we're a multicultural country, many more people are caught. Is that your argument?
Well, it's really two reasons. One reason is that back in 1901, you wouldn't have been caught if you were from New Zealand, Canada or the UK, because we shared the one citizenship. They weren't foreign powers. There wasn't a problem. And in fact, many of the politicians caught up in recent events are from those countries. But the second reason is yes, we have a migrant nation now in Australia. And back in 1901, they just didn't conceive that we could possibly have half the nation born in such a diversity of countries, or their parents born in such a diversity of their countries. And it means that in the world in which we live today, we have a section that's really ill-adapted for the community that we have in Australia.
Mm-hmm. And so what do, now that we've set the scene, what are the precedents in previous cases relating to this section tell us about what the High Court may or may not do in relation to these cases involving the government people and Nick Xenophon and Malcolm Roberts?
Well, for decades and decades, this section was just ignored, in part because we just didn't have the numbers who might have tripped over it. But the High Court first got involved as a full court back in 1992. There was a case called Sykes and Cleary, and we had a former Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, who resigned. We had a by-election, and an independent, Phil Cleary, won the seat. He was challenged on the basis that he fell afoul of a different part of Section 44 that says you can't have an office of profit under the Crown, and the High Court knocked him out as a schoolteacher. But there were two other candidates who did also have dual citizenship of Switzerland and Greece, and the High Court looked at them. They said, yes, they'd gone through a naturalisation ceremony. They thought they were only Australian citizens, but it turned out they hadn't renounced their citizenship under the law of those other countries. And the High Court said, unless you've done that or taken reasonable steps to do that, you're excluded. And so in both of those cases, they were struck out. They just hadn't taken steps to divest themselves of Swiss and Greek nationality.
And so what do those precedents tell us, as well as the facts of the cases themselves? Does it suggest to you that the High Court is likely to sort of take a pro forma approach with all of these people and hand down similar findings, or are there differences of fact and sort of potentially different application of precedent that means the High Court could say, you're fine, you're out, you're fine, you're out? what's your thought on that?
Well, certainly every case could be different because it will come down to the facts of the cases. But critically, what we'll have to look for is whether the High Court develops the law. At the moment, the law says if you're a dual citizen and you have not taken reasonable steps, you're out. And in fact, that would suggest that all of them are out because they haven't taken reasonable steps, it seems. So the question is, will the High Court fashion a new exception? Will it be a bit creative in this area? And perhaps it might say, for example, that it's not just reasonable steps that's an exclusion. Perhaps if there's no way you could have reasonably known that you're a citizen of another country, maybe it's an obscure law that's beyond what can reasonably be ascertained. So whichever approach they take, well, they'll then have to run a ruler over the candidates. And you'll have a difference from some candidates who've just left things too late, perhaps, and it's hard to see any excuse on that case. Some who are born in another country, so really they should have checked, perhaps, hard to see how they'll be saved. Or some who are citizens through descent. And maybe the High Court will say, well, if it's descent, you've got more of an excuse. But, you know, these are shades of grey, and they really do depend on the court being quite generous from its current approach.
Well, let's pick up generous, because it's sort of an interesting irony from my ledge anyway, that we have a sort of nominally conservative government quite obviously, openly, basically campaigning for the High Court to demonstrate a bit of judicial activism in relation to these cases. I think it's pretty obvious from what George Brandis has said and from what the Prime Minister has said that the government is relying on the High Court to interpret the section and to interpret the section in a, well, shall we say, in a sort of broader ambit than one may normally sort of want the High Court to interpret various sections. What do you make of that?
Oh, look, I think certainly it is ironic. The words of the Constitution are clear in excluding dual citizens. And yes, a conservative, technical, or a black letter approach, as it is often called, would suggest dual citizens are out. There's nothing in there that excludes people or saves them in the circumstances that the government is interested at the moment. So it needs words read in.
Yeah.
And that is exactly the sort of thing that conservative governments tend to rail against. Mm-hmm. We had former Prime Minister here, John Howard, many years ago, railing against the High Court for activism, for going beyond its proper role in areas like native title and constitutional interpretation. But certainly the wheel has turned, and I think there are some interesting comparisons between where the Turnbull government is today and the Whitlam government was in the 1970s.
Oh,
and,
yeah? Tell us about that.
Well, if you look at the Whitlam government, they had a adventurous constitutional agenda, which required the court to save its position, to take quite an adventurous path itself. The Whitlam government also faced a series of constitutional crises that threatened its existence and the legitimacy of Parliament. And you wouldn't expect to find many parallels between those eras. But in constitutional terms, there are. It's quite striking, the number of similarities. And so here again, we find the Turnbull government on this occasion really needing the High Court to save its members by taking an approach that Whitlam himself would have been happy with.
And what do we know about the current bench of the High Court that may give the government some cause for optimism on that front? Are we looking at a bunch of judicial activists? Who are we looking at?
Well, no. The current High Court has no one of an ilk of Michael Kirby, who's a former High Court judge who was well known for being progressive, open-minded, saw the Constitution as a living tree to be developed in new directions. No one of his ilk has been appointed for many years to the court. The current Conservative government has appointed 4 of the 7 members of the court. Labor has appointed 3, and all of those appointments are very fine judges, but they're not well known for their creativity and imagination when it comes to constitutional matters. So I think the government's going to find it quite difficult in the High Court, and the Prime Minister has suggested that he has confidence the High Court will decide that the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, will be cleared. I don't have that confidence. I actually think it's more likely than not that he'll be struck out. And I think in this area, you really need to be very cautious about predicting what the court will do in any event.
And is it likely, I was obviously sitting up in the press gallery when the Prime Minister made that remark, and I confess I snapped back in my chair slightly because of the offence of the separation of powers. It seemed a fairly bold thing to say. If you're the Prime Minister, it's almost like you're giving the court a direction. Are they likely to dwell on that? Is that likely to be part of their decision-making, or are they ruthless professionals who will just interpret the law?
Well, it was an unwise comment by the Prime Minister, and I can only imagine he misspoke. He's a very fine lawyer. He knows better. And it was unwise because, yes, it did suggest a direction or a desired outcome. And it's important politicians stick clear of that. We need an independent court. We don't need any suggestion they're under pressure. But look, they are fiercely independent. They may be annoyed by that statement, but really it will be water off a duck's back. They'll decide this the way they think. And the beauty of our system is that these judges have a fixed term until age 70. They're not beholden to any government. They're not seeking fear or favour. And it means that they can decide this the way they see it. And they'll start with the words of the Constitution. They'll look at their prior decisions on this matter. And they'll then apply that in light of the facts before them.
So revenge isn't a precedent.
No, I wouldn't think so. And it was pretty mild, really, in the scheme of things. Sure. And look, it was unwise, but I can't see it playing into anything much. I mean, I think it's more of interest to sort of political commentators in the court who will be fixated on the words and the other legal matters before them.
Sure. No, I am joking. let's not a joking matter. If we start from the point at which you say that if the court interprets the section in the way that it's been interpreted in the past, in all likelihood all these people are gone, all these people are binned, then I want to think for a couple of minutes about ministerial decision making, which is also territory the government really hasn't wanted to get into or has been very sort of focused on pivoting out of. There's a separate section in the Constitution, isn't there, that determines how it is that you become a minister. So how does that work? Let's start there before we get into the nuts and bolts of the decision making.
Sure. Well, Section 64 of the Constitution says that to be a minister, you must be a member of Parliament, but you can not be a member of Parliament and have 3 months of grace. But once the 3 months has ended, you can't be a minister. That's the way it works. And the tricky thing here for ministers who are caught up in this process is that if the High Court strikes them out, it will strike them out back to the last election. So July 2016, they then have 3 months from July 2016 for the period of grace. That will end towards the second half of next year, and they will have been ministers without any visible legal support. And I suspect that was one reason why Minister Matt Canavan stood down for concerns how it might affect his ministerial decision-making. But of course, Barnaby Joyce has not stood down, and it does open up a line of attack upon him if he's disqualified, that any decision he's made, particularly since his potential ineligibility came to notice, is something that people may take to the courts. And so there is a high-risk game they're playing here if he does make decisions, because there is that line of challenge.
And is it worse from a legal point of view that we have a minister, let's just take Joyce because we're talking about him, we have a minister in his case, a Deputy Prime Minister, who has also assumed the portfolio responsibilities of Matt Canavan, who stepped out of the Cabinet, as you say, because of concerns about ministerial decision making. So we've got Barnaby sort of spanning a number of portfolios. Now, he's making decisions presumably every single day. You know, ministers do. They issue determinations and directions and all kinds of things, even if they're not making big controversial decisions that are in the public domain. Is it worse from a legal point of view this period from when New Zealand famously claimed our Deputy Prime Minister and he now knows and has conceded himself that there's a question mark, hence his own referral to the High Court? Is it worse in this period when he knows that there's a question mark over whether he has been validly elected?
Look, there are. It is worse, and that's because there are rules of law that say that if everyone could reasonably have thought you were making decisions as a minister, then the court won't go back and look at those. They will just accept quite pragmatically that everyone's entitled to follow those decisions, and it'd be chaos if you undid things where there was no doubt. But yes, once that seed of doubt is raised, it's a different story, because in that case, the courts would say, well, people are not entitled to rely upon those decisions until this doubt is cleared. And so from that point where it appeared he may be a New Zealand citizen, we now know he is, the court may take a different view. And any decision during that period is at risk of being declared invalid. The question is whether someone will challenge. But if they do, it could overturn the decision they challenged, but all of the others as well. It may be what's happening is that he's deliberately not making any contentious decisions and hoping that the non-contentious ones will just slip by. But again, it's not a wise strategy, because it offers the opportunity of really furthering the uncertainty and, again, miring the government in litigation. in ways that presumably it would like to avoid.
Well, we can just take one example, the gas export control power. Let's just pull that one off the shelf for the moment. We know that the Australian gas industry is not a fan of that export control power that the government is seeking to use in order to build domestic gas supply and make sure that there's all the gas is not exported. I don't think that, obviously that's been talked about. There's been some preliminary steps taken in the event that Barnaby Joyce were to implement that over the next couple of weeks. How do you reckon that'd go?
Look, I think if you've got a cashed up group that is motivated to challenge where there's a good argument, well, why wouldn't they? Mm. And that's exactly his problem. It's not even cashed up groups. If there's any decisions about the Adani coal mine in Queensland, I mean, we've already seen a particularly litigious set of groups who are willing to challenge any aspect of that. So you'd imagine that just prudence would say he would avoid any decisions in those sorts of areas, but maybe you can't. I mean, there may be timelines and the like. And at some point, perhaps they may be forced to actually transfer some of these powers, if only to get certainty about these matters.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, would there be an option perhaps for them to delegate powers to a cabinet colleague perhaps, or some way, I've been thinking myself, how could you possibly work around
this? Yeah, you can do
this?
That. And often when a government comes in, it allocates ministerial responsibilities, who's responsible for what act. And that would be a possibility to have him as a minister in name only, but to actually give all of his powers to someone else. And that would be wise for them to do that. But I suppose they'll be reluctant, if only because they've now dug their heels in and not had him resign. They won't want to give any sense of credence to concerns he shouldn't still be in the position. And that would give credence to those concerns. Mm. So they've really got themselves in a difficult situation here. And the least worst for them will probably be just don't make any decisions or to risk it.
Yes.
But neither are desirable.
No, quite. Okay, now let's just talk about, I want to talk to you briefly about the postal plebiscite for same-sex marriage, but before we get to that, we've sort of skirted it, but we haven't really nailed it, whether or not the provisions of the Constitution are reasonable in modern Australia. What's your view about that? Let's just think about the dual citizen thing first. Is it reasonable in contemporary multicultural Australia to have a prohibition in the Constitution against, in essence, against dual citizenship?
Well, and the short answer is no. It's in fact not reasonable. It's ridiculous that we should have it.
A lot of people would say, though, why is it unreasonable that a politician be a citizen of Australia and Australia only if they are representing us in Parliament?
Well, the reason, in short order, is that by having this provision, we leave the eligibility of our members of Parliament to the laws of other countries. So it actually runs counter to our sovereignty, our capacity to determine who should represent us. And to give you an example of how far this goes, one example that's come up is the position of Ecuador. And Ecuador has got a new constitution in 2008. It says that where someone is born in Ecuador, they don't even have to be a citizen, but where they're born, their children, their grandchildren and great-grandchildren are all have the capacity to be Ecuadorian citizens. So if you're in Parliament, you better keep up with your great-grandparents, where they were born. You better know South American law and be aware that if it changes, you may have to take steps. And not just that country, but if you look at Nick Xenophon in the case of Cypriot citizenship, you better know the colonial situation and how citizenship plays out. And when I looked at that, I came across the leading work as a 2,000-page book trying to disentangle how these rules work. So we're leaving our system of government and its stability vulnerable to what happens elsewhere that even the own countries often can't unpick. And I mean, why would you set up a system like that? It's why the UK, Canada, the US, other countries, they don't do this because it just doesn't make sense in the modern world, nor does it make sense for the security of the country to leave itself open to these problems.
And is there any other mechanism to change the eligibility requirements apart from putting it to a referendum? Could the Parliament legislate? Is there some? Because they obviously seem very reluctant to. There's all this sort of broad hints to the High Court. Could you please fix this up for us? Brackets, because we really don't want the inconvenience of a referendum. So they clearly don't want to do it. So is there any other workaround that they could put in place?
Oh, not really. No. And
I've been trying to think what you could do.
The text of the Constitution trumps everything. It's the national law. But yes, there's a reluctance, but it doesn't look good compared to the willingness to have the postal survey. That costs $122 million. Holding a referendum to change sections 44 at an election will be $60 million. So we're spending double on a vote we don't need. And you need also to remember that Parliament hasn't come to this without knowledge. There have been three processes Parliament has looked at Section 44. 1981, there was a constitutional commission in 88. There was an inquiry that I and others gave evidence to in 97. Everyone said this is broken, it must be fixed, and if we don't, it's a time bomb. At some point, this is going to cause grave problems. And Parliament's hoping the High Court will fix the problem for it, but it is the Parliament has the responsibility and the capacity, and only it can change these words.
And would you, it's certainly my view that this is a little microcosm for the distinct lack of seriousness by which Australian politics approaches its own standards of governance and compliance. Am I being nitpicky and unreasonable?
Oh, look, particularly in the area of constitutional change, no, it's very true. There's a sense of we just don't need to deal with these things. We can be complacent about it. The system works okay. It wasn't always like that, though. We've had referendums in Australia on average every 2.5 years since Federation to change something in the Constitution, but not a single referendum since that on the Republic in 1999. So it's actually the last two decades that is the real mark of shame in public policy in Australia. And we've got to this point where they've just got out of the habit of even doing these things. But if you get out of the habit of updating a document that can go out of date, it's drafted in 1901, you pay a price at some point. And it's just an area of public policy that you neglect at your peril.
And we've seen that playing out. And let's just finish up with the same-sex marriage plebiscite, which you've pointed out very neatly is very expensive waste of money. But will it get through the High Court? What's your view on that?
Well, the High Court argument centres on one question, and that is a line of authority that the High Court has developed to strike down the National Schools Chaplaincy Program twice, as it turns out. And the High Court has said that the government can't spend money unless it's authorised by Parliament. Now, here, the government's twice tried to get parliamentary support, been rebuffed. So it doesn't have that authorisation through that legislation. The government says it's found a backdoor method of doing this. It wants to give the finance minister an advance of the $122 million, and it is allowed to do that according to law if this is for something urgent and unforeseen.
Yeah.
So the key question here is, well, is the postal survey urgent and unforeseen? And look, I think that's a tough ask. I think that it's not urgent except according to the government's own political priorities. And unforeseen, we've been debating this for years.
Yeah.
So unless the government comes up with something new or again finds a court willing to backtrack on some of its earlier authority, it's in trouble. And my best guess is that it's likely the postal survey will be struck down, in which case all of the campaigning will come to a screaming halt and it'll be over. It may not. You do really predict these things at your peril, but you know, my reading is that's the more likely result in this case.
And do we have precedents on the use of ministerial power under the Finance Minister's Advance to look at? Do we have anything that gives us a guide about what the High Court may think? I mean, you're pretty definite there. You think it's in all manner of trouble.
Oh, look, there's no doubt it's in real trouble. And that's why the government wanted legislation.
Yeah.
In part, because it's well aware of this. The High Court has said in a number of cases you need parliamentary approval for expenditure. And no, there's no good precedents either way that I can point to. And that's why it really will come down to these words, urgent and unforeseen.
Yeah.
And look, the High Court could clearly find in favour of the government. It could go both ways. In the absence of a clear answer, it'll depend upon the arguments. We've got 2 days of argument in the High Court. It's just that my reading is the government has got the harder battle in this. And that's why I think, you know, on balance, just more likely than not, I think they'll probably lose. But, you know, we'll see.
We will indeed. So maybe consume all those advertisements, whether you like, loathe or are indifferent to them quickly because
this could be short-lived.
That's right. They may prove a transient feature of our landscape. We'll just have to stay tuned.
Well, indeed. And what will happen, of course, is if it does get struck down, it'll go back perhaps to Parliament with a conscience vote, but the government won't have its citizenship issues resolved. And so these issues will overlap, that we'll have an uncertain membership of Parliament at the same time that people are saying it's got to look at this again. These issues could come together in a nasty way.
Well, it's a true, I think I wrote a couple of weeks ago that in relation to the same-sex a postal survey that the entire Liberal Party was looking at the High Court and holding its breath. And I think that's not journalistic overstatement in this instance. I think that is actually true because the consequences of this coming back in an unmanaged way into the political environment, I think are very dicey and dangerous.
Well, and indeed the last time we had a government with such bated breath was the Whitlam government in the 70s and a range of issues where it was dependent upon good High Court decisions. The interesting thing about Whitlam is during his time in office, he won every case in the High Court.
Right.
Whether Turnbull has that record, we'll have to wait
and see.
We're
going to find out. Beautiful note to end on. George Williams, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening. We're very grateful, as always. You can download this podcast and subscribe via your favourite app or however it is, basically, that you get your other podcasts. If it happens to be on iTunes, do stop by and give us a rating or a review, as I say every single week, and doubtless you're sick of it. It does help the profile of the project and helps us build an audience for it. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni, who is the producer of this pod and other pod material from Guardian Australia. And you can search for Miles's other work, Behind the Lines, and other podcasts by searching, basically in the same way that you look for us. Now, Parliament is about to resume very shortly. I'll be back next week in some shape or form with some sort of a conversation. And I've been grateful of a couple of weeks' respite, given how crazy the last sitting period was. And I make no predictions, basically, about what will happen once Parliament resumes, apart from bring dried rations, some snacks, some water, and a crash helmet. See you soon.